Today we will be having the continuation of our budget overview and presentation. And today, starting it out, it looks like it's state roads, programming, planning, and delivery with Mr. Mike Barnes. Mr. Barnes, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thanks for the opportunity to be here this afternoon. I'm Mike Barnes. I'm the director of the operations division at MnDOT. And I'm here today to cover a portion of the state roads program budget, which you'll see here that we have two more with Mark Giesecke covering electronic communications, and Tim Hinkle will cover the state road construction and debt service. I'll be referencing the budget narrative and giving the page numbers as part of this. So the actual program description starts on page 35 with the budget on 36. So I'll start with the purpose. The purpose of the state roads program is to oversee the road system that's owned by MnDOT. It covers the trunk highway system and the other assets like the rest areas, the trails, park and rides. The responsibilities in this area include the planning, design, right-of-way, construction, maintenance, and operations of the road system. It includes those things that might include like the shoulders and drainage, bridges, signals, signs, lighting, and so on. This program accounts for $2.7 billion of the budget and covers about 30,000 lane miles of trunk highway and about 4,300 of the FTEs at MnDOT. And as I'd referenced, these are the five budget activity areas that we will be covering today. The first budget activity that I'll cover is the program planning and delivery, which is on page 38. You can just see just briefly on the activities as a glance. You can see we had $1.55 billion in construction awards in 2008 and 9. It just kind of shows the magnitude of the size of what we're delivering in there. And 837 construction projects that were there with over 400 right-of-way parcels. From the actual services, so I get a kind of a basis so you see what's covered in this area. I'll cover each of these services from that starting on page 38. The statewide system planning integration service is what we use to provide the short and long-range planning policy making. This is where you see the 20-year state transportation plan, the 10-year HIP, which is the highway investment plan. You'll see us work with corridor plans and district plans, bike plans, and so on. This area, this service also covers MnDOT's research program, so we can advance new tools, techniques, and best practices in the department. The State Road Construction Program Management Service. This service is the one that directs the development and implementation of the state road construction program and the federal funding programs. This is where you'll see the four-year state Transportation Improvement Program, or our STIP, and you'll see the Area Transportation Improvement Programs. And this is the one that also provides for program finance tracking and reporting under this service. The last one in this area is the Construction Project Development Program. Actually, this says and management. There's two pieces to this. Is the project development service is those activities that we do before the actual construction begins, and that's like the scoping of the project, construction limits, doing the environmental documents, right-of-way acquisition, design, plan delivery, and getting us through the lettings. This also then the construction project management portion of it is where we go out and do the field inspections and the testing and doing the documentation out on the project and actually paying to the contractor, all within that service. So overall, what the main goal of this activity is for us to be able to deliver the right size project on time, on budget, and of good quality. On pages 38 and 39, you also see some example measures that we've put in there. So it shows things like the percent of construction projects that were let on schedule, percent of projects that have scoping documents, kind of our average right-of-way time and project cost variance. So you can get a feel of the measures that we're doing to try to see that we are ambient success in this area. From a dollar standpoint, this activity has a $414 million direct appropriation, $35 million of statutory, for a total of $449 million for the biennium for this activity. This slide shows the pie chart that shows the categories for spending. You'll see that the total compensation is $311 million, and the other expenses of $130 million, with a capital outlay and real property of $6 million, local assistance of $2 million, for a total of the same $449 million. Just another view of it. What I'll do now is cover the second budget activity of operations and maintenance. That starts on page 42 of the narrative. This activity is the maintaining, operating, and preserving of our state trunk and interstate highway systems. This covers our roads, our bridges, the roadsides, safety equipment, our traffic control and traffic management type devices. And as you can see from this activities at a glance, that there's a large number of some key assets that we're maintaining here. And not to go through each and every one, but you can see there that there's a large number of traffic management systems and lighting systems and equipment, like you see from the number of snowplow trucks and so on. So there's a pretty large asset base there. What I'll do is similar here, is just kind of walk through so you get a better idea of this activity and the services. So you can, this is probably one of the areas that MnDOT's the most visible in, is the maintenance activity. The clear roads is the one where we put the budget for clearing snow, ice, and the debris off the road. And we have targets that we set that are based on customer expectations. So we try to get to a bare lane, and like our higher volume roads, it'd be 3 hours, and lower volume have different hours set to them. The smooth roads areas where we do our patching, shoulder repair, drainage repair. This one's focused on providing a smooth ride, and we have a rideability measure that we do annually to help us determine where we're at for that ride. Under the roadside area, this is where we have the brush and tree removal that we do for safety and visibility, and mowing, and also doing the legally mandated spraying for noxious weeds. In the bridges service area, this is where we do the inspecting, maintaining, and repairing of our bridges to keep them safe and in service. The building management service is where we do the operating and maintaining of all our buildings that the deputy referenced at the last presentation. This is the area where we do the maintaining and of those owned by MnDOT. And the rest area management, that's where we do the general maintenance, the operations, and the janitorial-type services for that. The operations services, then, the areas covered here are traffic management. This is where we cover the signing, the lighting, the striping, the traffic signals, guardrail, and the actual operations then too of our regional transportation management system, our center, the RTMC, and also where we do our traveler information. The regulation service is where we issue permits. We control work by contractors that are in our right-of-way, and we identify safe routes for wide or overweight loads. And finally, with this, the service for the inventory control is the one that covers the purchasing and warehousing and issuing materials, and we also do our hazardous waste coordination in that service.
Mr. Chair. Senator Burr? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Got a question. Let's talk a little bit about fleet management and how that's been going. Now, is it my understanding that admin doesn't take care of your fleet management, does it? You take care of your own? Transportation's been carved out?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct. We have fleet management. We are working, there's some activities that we're working at a state level and working together, but overall we do manage our fleet.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burr, could you give us a rundown? How big is the fleet, what we have, and how you're managing that, how you rotate through? I mean, obviously, I'm trying to recall some of the stuff that I've read about in the past with fleet management for the state and issues of when we buy and sell and how we buy and sell and move the fleet in and out as they become used and worn, and I'm just kind of trying to get a handle on that.
Mr. Barnes?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Mr. Steve Lund, our state maintenance engineer here, help answer some of those since that area is within his office.
Senator, Mr. Chair, my name is Stephen Lund. I'm the state maintenance engineer for the Department of Transportation. I'll just do some general comments, and then if there's anything more specific about fleet management, you can have a follow-up question, of course. We have over 3,000 mobile vehicles. They range from light-duty vehicles to heavy-duty vehicles. Our most visible entity is our snowplow fleet probably. We have approximately 780 plow route trucks that we actually put on routes. We have approximately 40-some reserve plows that are available as well. Again, we have various heavy other heavy-duty equipment ranging from excavators to heavy loaders, backhoes, a wide range of types of heavy equipment. We have performance measures in our fleet area where we do look at primarily three components for managing the fleet. And two of the key performance measures are life cycle, where we actually have a targeted life cycle for our equipment, and then also on utilization. And that could be either by miles or hours, depending on the type of equipment it is. And the third category where we do manage our fleet is through a combination of looking at preventative maintenance and reactive maintenance.
Sure, thank you. I'm always curious on whether or not we look to see if, when we're starting to talk about, you know, loaders and excavators and some of the equipment that doesn't appear that it gets used enough that would require to have us in the fleet. Have you ever looked at what it would be on some of these projects to lease or just rent for the project period?
Mr. Chair, we actually, through our measures effort, very much so look at that issue. And we do a fair amount of renting and leasing. And through our utilization, I guess, again, we have targets that we do aim for minimum utilization. We have nine categories that we track our fleet. Five of those categories are based on miles, depending, again, on the type of equipment, and four of the categories of the nine are based on hours. So the backhoes and things that run more on an hour meter are tracked that way. And correct, we do have minimum targets that we manage against in maintaining fleet. And we do a very good job of sharing at the grassroots level. We don't track that as well as maybe reporting as we could, but we know that's where the efficiency is sharing at the grassroots level instead of putting formal overhead in terms of agreements to move it back and forth. We allow our superintendents and supervisors to deal with sharing at that level.
Wonderful. Thank you. What about multi-use, I better explain it. You have the power plant of a combine that does peas and corn and whatever. I mean, you use the fleet for multi-purpose, you know, rather than have a snowplow sit and do nothing in the middle of the summer. I mean,
correct, Mr. Senator, Mr. Chair. The snowplow fleet is actually probably one of our higher utilized pieces of equipment because of its versatility in the summer season. We do much hauling with that, and we do a lot of work with our plow fleet through summer maintenance activity. The front plow comes off, of course, and we use their tandem and single axle dump truck, and we use those for our summer activities.
Thank you, Mr. Lund, and you can proceed, Mr. Barnes.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I finished on the inventory control, and then for the on pages 44 to 47, it also shows some of the measures that we do for this activity, like for the safety, mobility, the clear roads measure that I had previously mentioned, then smooth roads and bridge. So again, those are sample measures that are in there to give you an idea of what we're trying to track for this activity, these services. As we see on this here, the direct appropriations for this is about $515 million, statutory $25 million, for a biennium total of $540 million. With the next slide, showing the pie chart here, with the categories where there's $313 million in total compensation and other operating expenses of $227 million, which half of that being things of the sand, salt, fuel area that we're talking about here. And then for the same biennium, the total then again at the bottom of $540 million. The slide here now is as a deputy referenced in this first presentation, that this is one of the change items that related to the DBE collaborative efforts. It's to be able to remedy either past, present discrimination in our highway construction industry. And there is proposed legislation that's being looked at to implement a targeted group business program, or TGB. And so this here is a proposal for $130,000 within the program planning and delivery appropriation, and it's to be able to add two staff for that program startup. So this is bringing it up here because it fits within the program delivery of the first two items that I had covered. So at this point, this would end my portion, Mr. Chair, of the state roads program, but be open for
questions. Hang around for a little bit, Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we talk a little bit about this DBE program? Now, how long has it been in effect? Is it a couple of years? Is that my understanding? Or
Mr. Barnes?
Mr. Chair, Senator, when you say from the DBE program, I'm not quite the collaborative we've had for a couple of years. So the actual collaborative efforts and bringing people together and working through and coming up with action items of what to do to improve has been just the last couple of years. But the Office of Civil Rights within the department has been around for a long time and has been a legal aspect of it. So,
Senator Perry?
Is it working as far as its intended purpose?
Mr. Barnes?
Mr. Chair, Senator, as far as we've been working through, and there's been the legal requirements that we've gone through for over the years, but from many different views that have been in the collaborative, there's the actual the DBEs and those that are doing the training. There's been a different view of what is success, and it hasn't been viewed the same. And what we've done as a department has been more proactive to move on the DBE efforts and put together the collaborative. And I think we're at a much better place of understanding for the overall program. And this is one of those, the TGB program itself is recommendations coming out of that group to move forward with. And so for us as a department, this is one of those items to be able to help us move forward with it. So
this is an initiative of Commissioner Sorrell's that he's been working on for a significant period of time, trying to work through the details of this. The collaborative was a part of that. We just received their report. But see, Mr. Peterson is here. Would you be interested in offering maybe just a little bit more clarity on the DBE program and this additional funding for $130,000 for the two additional employees?
Mr.
If
Chair,
you are willing to weigh in, I don't mean to put you on the spot, Mr. Peterson.
Just maybe I could
Senator Perry.
Make a couple of statements before Mr. Peterson. I guess what my question really boils down to be is, what is the purpose and the mission of the DBE? Has it helped or hampered transportation and how we do our projects? Has it been a hindrance? Is it holding up processes? Obviously, when we're in this area of looking what we're doing with the dollars that we have, and maybe I could say, Mr. Peterson, I've heard that maybe it's held up a program or two, and I think those are what we need to address before we start throwing more money at it. If we can't get to that point where it is a true benefit for, then we have to look at something different. Maybe that's a little clarification what I'm really trying to get at.
Mr. Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Scott Peterson from MnDOT. And the DBE program is a federal program that was imposed to help redress past discrimination. So over the years, they've been able to demonstrate that there has been discrimination in the construction industry against people with disadvantaged groups, ethnic minorities and women in particular. And so this program was established several decades ago in order to help address that fact. And so for our construction projects, there are goals established for DBE participation. So that's a minority or woman-owned contract. And that varies depending upon where it is around the state. And we historically have struggled to reach our goals. The collaborative was established to help the department develop strategies and methods for improving the performance and our ability to achieve the established goals. There have been a couple projects, I believe, at least one in particular, where the response to the requirement to reach the goal was insufficient. I should back up a little bit, too. The contractor is not required to achieve the goal in order to receive the contract. They either have to demonstrate that they can reach the goal or show good faith effort to have achieved it. And so if they claim that they've made a good faith effort and weren't able to achieve the goal, then the department reviews their determination and then decides whether it's valid or not. And in at least one case that I'm aware of, and there may be more, the department determined that the good faith effort as it was presented wasn't sufficient, and so the contract was awarded, I believe, either to the next lowest bidder or rebid. The Targeted Group Business Program is a new program that reestablishes a program that was discontinued, I believe, about 10 years ago as a result of a lawsuit. And the department went back and conducted another disparity study where the consultant actually looked at the participation in construction contracts in the state of Minnesota to determine whether discrimination still existed against minorities and women-owned businesses. And it was determined that discrimination continued to exist. And so we are attempting to, or we're going to have legislation this year to reestablish that program. And this would apply to contracts that are funded entirely with state funds. So if there's $1 of federal money involved in the contract, then the federal DBE program applies. If it's entirely state funded, then it would be governed by the rules of this yet to be established targeted group business program. And as I believe Mr. Barnes mentioned, this is a recommendation of our collaborative. The $130,000 change request is for two staff people to help administer the new program.
Just quickly, are the goals for the DBE and the certainly the targeted group businesses are set here in the state, right? But as far as the DBE, are those goals and objectives, are they set by federal guidelines, or is that something that is set within the department or the division?
Mr. Chairman, the process, for the most part, is established in federal regulation. The goals are established at the local level. In fact, we even have sub-state goals. So the office registers qualified disadvantaged business enterprises, and they have a particular part of the work that they do, for example, you know, guardrail installation or paving or grading. I mean, I don't know exactly where they all fall, but and they're located around the state. And so in places where there are fewer disadvantaged business enterprises located or available to bid on projects, the goal for participation is lower. In the metro area, we tend to have more of those companies, and so the goals tend to be a little bit higher here than they would be, for example, in maybe some, like in southwestern Minnesota, for example, where perhaps they have fewer, just speculating.
Senator Perry?
Thank you. In this program, I'm trying to get in my mind just where the disadvantage, or can you give me some examples of what we're talking here and what's happened and that's really created bringing forth this TGB again? I'm just trying to. It to me is if we're going out and we have a contract that we have out and it's offered, anyone has the right to go after that contract. Are we setting it up so that we're giving an inferior contractor the opportunity to get the contract? Or help me out with this disadvantage part. I mean,
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perry, I believe the disadvantage part refers to the fact that they have not, or they've experienced certain disadvantages when attempting to get work. I think the expectation for the quality of work that the contractor does is the same. I don't know if the price is always the same, but the expectations or the specs that they're required to perform to are the same, regardless of whether it's a disadvantaged business enterprise or a contractor who wouldn't fall into that classification. And again, what the program has attempted to address is what has been demonstrated to be a statistically significant underrepresentation of these groups in the winning bids for the work that the state awards. And so there's a targeted group business program that already exists that other agencies in the state use for their contracting. The department hasn't been participating in the program until we're able to complete this disparity study that I mentioned. And so now we've been through that process. Again, it's reestablished the existence of discrimination, and this program is intended to help redress that discrimination.
Senator DeCrack.
Thank you.
Pull your microphone over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. Are we mandated to do this program, or by the federal government or by the state? Are we mandated to do this or not? And secondly, is it just that we don't have disadvantaged people in this field? So are we trying to see businesses be started? Are we trying to create businesses to bring people into this industry? Or can you explain that to me?
Mr. Peters.
Sir, Chairman, Senator DeCrive, I think let me back up. The participation in the program is mandatory if we're to accept federal funds for our construction projects. So that's a part of the regulations regarding acceptance of federal funds. And I believe the purpose of the program, again, is to help minority and women-owned businesses get some construction business and help them build a successful business and eventually not qualify for that status so that they become successful businesses in their own right and able to compete on their own for construction contracts outside of the impact of discrimination.
Okay. Mr. Chair, can I just have a quick follow-up?
Certainly. Senator Grief.
What process is in place other than a couple of people on staff to help them, are they given some extra latitude in bidding? Are they given a disproportionate advantage in quoting on a job, or what do we do to help them? I'm curious.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Peterson.
Senator DeCrive. I guess the advantage comes from we put the requirement to the contractor, the winning bidder, the prime contractor. We require them to either hire a certain percentage of their work to be done by contractors that are qualified DBEs or show good faith effort that they weren't able to meet that requirement. So there's no monetary incentive or anything else other than that requirement that they achieve that percentage.
Sure.
Or show good faith effort.
I just wanted to point out to the committee and the members here that we are going to have the DBE discussion and on March 1st at our committee hearing, so we'll be able to get into the more of the details rather than put Mr. Peterson on the spot here at this point in time. But of interest, of course, to us as a budgetary matter is the addition of two additional people and the $130,000. But we'll have a thorough vetting of this topic here on March 1st. So. Senator Dibble?
I'll wait till March 1st. The only point I was going to make was I think where people might get caught up is some perception that there's a guarantee of outcome and there isn't. In trying to make sure that the workforce reflects the population of our state when we're spending millions and billions of dollars of our taxpayer resources, all the taxpayers should be participating in that economic activity, and it's simply the fact is that this has been a very difficult industry for some non-traditional communities to break into. It's been kind of a closed industry. Lots of folks have been, just because of relationships and how things just kind of evolve over time. And it's an effort to get some communities who haven't been able to participate in these kinds of jobs to be able to participate.
And this industry is capital intensive, and there's a lot of equipment involved, and you know, it's not just the image that I think is that's being portrayed, that it's somewhat prejudicial in the intent of the on the part of the contractors of the department. I don't think that's the case, and we'll see that when we have the DBE discussion. But more the maybe a little bit of the closeness of the contractors and the system itself. But certainly there are other economic factors that are involved in this too, and we'll have that discussion on March 1st. But
yeah,
appreciate you handling the questions, Mr. Peterson, and I think we'll move on with the.
If I could just support that last comment of yours, Mr. Chair, folks have been kind of gathered around this problem for the past year and a half or so from the contracting community and the heavy trades, heavy labor trades, whatever you call them, you know, heavy machine labor, the 49ers, et cetera, and others have really, I mean, they acknowledge that this is a unique situation and it's a tough nut to crack, and they've been working really, really hard themselves, so there's a lot of credit to go around.
And thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Barnes?
Okay. If there's no further questions, then I'll be followed by Mr. Mark Giesecke on the electronic communications.
Mr. Giesecke, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Giesecke. I'm the director of the Office of Electronic Communications at MnDOT. And I'll be presenting the budget line for electronic communications, which is on page 50 of the narrative. Of all the activities that this line item supports, the primary one is the design, construction, operation, and maintenance of the statewide public safety radio system, which we call ARMOR. ARMOR relatively recently became a statewide program. As of today, it's about 60% deployed by count of towers on the air, and we estimate that that provides about 75% coverage of the geographic area of the state. The goal for the entire system at completion is 95% mobile coverage in each county of the state. Other activities under this budget item include system planning and implementation, which is also currently heavily focused on ARMOR. In acquiring, designing, and construction management of 50 tower sites per year for the next 2 years. We also perform communication system upgrades and communication infrastructure maintenance. In addition to maintaining the ARMOR backbone, we also maintain the portable and mobile subscriber radios that would be found in cars or that users would carry with them for the DOT as well as most of the other state agencies. That's 13,000 plus radios in addition to the base stations at tower sites, preventive maintenance, and other kinds of tower site maintenance. We also perform electronic equipment repair of other kinds, non-radio types of repairs for MnDOT and other agencies, and we have an inventory system for radio parts. The products and services that are covered under electronic communications are electronic communications investments and planning, which is the design, construction, and operations, electronic communications management, which is the maintenance. We provide external transportation system support to other agencies, and electronic communications administration. Our appropriations of $5.171 million direct appropriations is almost entirely from the Trunk Highway Fund. So the total appropriations is about $28 million. That $28 million does not include a $5 million annual transfer that we get from the Department of Public Safety from the 911 fees. But that is included on this screen, which is why this one adds up to 38, because it includes the additional $10 million transfer so that our total operating expenditures are about $25 million for the biennium and salary compensation of about $13 million. We do have one change request. We are requesting an increase in the funding for electronic communications to operate and maintain the ARMOR system of $3.24 million in fiscal year 12 and $3.59 million in fiscal year 2013. So that's a total of $6.83 million for the biennium. We are requesting that that money come from the 911 special revenue account and working in partnership with the Department of Public Safety on that. The reason for the increase, the construction of the armored backbone is proceeding on schedule, and it's simply that we have more sites to maintain. We have about 200 sites that exist now. There'll be something over 300 in a couple of years. So this increase is just due to the increase in the number of towers and the need to maintain them, pay the utilities, and so on.
Mr. Giesecke, could you talk a little bit about the relationship between the local law enforcement and use of the armor system, and also, I guess I didn't realize till today that MnDOT was the creating the backbone for the armor system and that whole relationship with the 911 fund and all of that. Could you offer us a little bit more clarity? Are those local law enforcement agencies contributing? Are they buying their own equipment? Are they paying a subscription for the service, that type of thing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the armor system is a partnership. It's governed by the statewide radio board, which has representation from state agencies and local agencies, both metro and outstate. There's kind of a balance there. They govern the system. The Department of Public Safety has the responsibility for implementing the system, and they contract with MnDOT to actually build and own the infrastructure. We receive some trunk highway funds, but mostly 911 funds from the Department of Public Safety to build the backbone of the system. The backbone is meant to be sufficient for state agency needs across the state. Then any excess capacity that's available on that system is available to share with local agencies. And so the system has been designed with some excess capacity. Currently, 71 of the 87 counties have made the commitment to join Armor. When they join Armor, they are responsible for buying their own subscriber equipment, so their own handheld portables or mobiles that they put in their vehicles. And if there's any need to add anything to the backbone to make it suitable for their use, either additional sites or more capacity at a site, they're responsible for paying for and adding that infrastructure.
Very interesting. How did the trunk highway funds get involved in this armor system, if you don't mind asking?
Mr. Chair, the legacy system provided service to the State Patrol and MnDOT, both trunk highway fund agencies. And so that's been that way for many years. When the new system was designed and implemented, that amount of investment was seen as the appropriate amount of investment to continue on as kind of the trunk highway's share for the use of the system.
Thank you. Senator Reiner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up question on that. In the House, I was on public safety, and I know not everyone was in agreement that the 9/11 Special Revenue Fund should fund the expansion of the armor system. You sort of referenced that, but as a casual reference, I'd appreciate an update on that. And then, Mr. Chair, traditionally, this committee's not had jurisdiction over that fund, or are we going to? Will that be part of our budget discussion?
Mr. Giesecke?
Mr. Chair, Senator Reinert, we work in close partnership with the Department of Public Safety on the use of that fund. We're under contract with them to provide the system. Really, it's kind of here for your information. We maintain the entire armor system, and we couldn't do it without the funds that are provided by the Department of Public Safety, but the request is going through the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you, and that answers my other question.
Thank you, Senator.
As far as jurisdiction, thank you.
You would want to continue?
And that's the end of my presentation.
Okay. It's the end of the communications portion of this. Thank you, Mr. Giesecke. Do you have a relation that was also with MnDOT? Marv Giesecke?
Yes. Yes, that would have been my father. Yep.
That's your father. Very interesting. A district engineer out of District 8.
Yep.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Henkel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Good afternoon. My name is Tim Hinkle. I'm an assistant commissioner responsible for the modal program and planning and program management division at MnDOT. I will complete MnDOT's briefing on the MnDOT budget recommendations with an overview of the state roads program, the state roads construction activity, as well as the debt payment activity, with a couple of change items as well to discuss. Starting first with the state road construction activity. As you can see here, and again in your budget narratives, this would be located on page 57. This activity and the budget is dedicated to the state road and bridge construction program and is the actual construction, reconstruction, and improvement of the trunk highways, including design build contracts, as well as those funds that will go to consultant usage to support the activities, and includes the actual payment for things like purchase of right-of-way, as one example. The appropriation recommendation varies by fiscal year, and our change item does get to this difference. The spending authority that is necessary on an annual basis will vary depending on the construction program and the needs of that construction program. So you're seeing a variation here that reflects the amount of spending authority that is necessary in fiscal year 2012 versus 2013. The total budget recommendation for the biennium is $1.416 million. And the spending plan, as you can see here, is focused primarily on the capital investment of actual construction programs, with the capital outlay and real property acquisition costs at 99.5% of the program. There is other operating expenses, and the placeholder that we have here at $6 million is for some of the consulting services that support that capital outlay in that overall spending plan. Next slide. The first change level request is for an increase to the state road construction program, the appropriation, by $146 million in fiscal year 2012, and an associated decrease to it by $80 million in fiscal year 2013. As you can see, this is a net of $66 million increase for the biennium as well, which reflects, as Mr. Arsenault said at our last hearing, the higher level of federal funds that will be coming to the state in the biennium period that we are talking about. Specifically, we are looking at some adjustments that decrease the need in 2013 because we are advancing two very large major construction projects. Those two projects are number one, the Cayuga Bridge on 35E, just north of the interchange in downtown St. Paul, as well as the Dresbach Bridge, just south of Winona, which are significant price tags. Those adjustments require more spending in the early year of the biennium, which then allows us to manage in 2012 and 2013. Next slide. The other change level request is associated with an increase that we will see in a category of federal funding that comes to the state for purposes of state planning and research. SPNR is the acronym that you will often hear. This description is located for you on page 13 of your budget narrative if you need to see more details. This particular change level request of the governor recommends increasing the appropriations related to design and construction engineering from the Trunk Highway Fund by $865,000 in fiscal year 2012 and $680,000 in 2013. This spending is going to go to additional data collection efforts as well as additional data analysis activities across the state on the trunk highway system, and so that the department has improved data collection efforts as well as traffic monitoring and weight in motion data so that the department is in a better position to understand the impacts of traffic on the trunk highway system, as well as to make more informed decisions about investments and the priorities for those investments on that trunk highway infrastructure.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate someone from your office sent me over the good quality ride index sheet, and I was just wondering, you had some projections out, you know, and there were some pretty significant changes based on the transportation districts, and I was just wondering how you made those projections, because, you know, as I spoke earlier, transportation District 6 has the, currently in 2010, has the lowest good ride quality index. But I see that it won't be in the projections out. And I was just wondering if you, maybe now is the time not to speak to it, but if we can get the rationale of what that graph chart and how those changes are assumed.
Mr. Hinkle?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Howe, we can have a more detailed conversation, but the general response is that prediction is based upon models that the department uses based on the actual results of construction activities and what we see in terms of that ride quality as well as the infrastructure status. And then we project that out over time based upon those real happenings, based upon the program and investment that we intend for each of those districts. We can get into more detail with that model and how that works and how accurate those projections are.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could continue.
Mr. Engel.
The next activity under state roads that I'd like to speak to is debt service. This is on page 54 of your budget narrative. This activity encompasses the repayment of the trunk highway bonds and other types of debt. The state of Minnesota is authorized to issue general obligation bonds for trunk highway purposes under the current constitution. MnDOT is authorized to enter into loan agreements using the Transportation Revolving Loan Fund and to enter into local advance agreements. Trunk highway debt service costs are down significantly for the biennium with lower interest rates and refinancing of debt in fiscal year 11. As you can see from this slide, there is a list of all of those authorizations that have been provided that give us the current total available for bond authorization. You can see that goes way back to Laws 2003 Chapter 19 all the way up to the recent Laws 2010 Chapter 388. That provide that authorization. The total currently is $2.479 billion. Our current debt policy gives us a debt threshold by which we can manage the overall repayment from the Trunk Highway Fund for debt service. And that debt service policy states that the threshold cannot exceed 20% of the annual projected state revenues to the Trunk Highway Fund. The recommended budget to continue the repayments for the currently issued bonds and what is expected in the biennium will be 114 to 151 in direct million of appropriations for a grand total of 266,149 million. Now, if you go to the next slide, you can see what those transfers look like from the Trunk Highway Funds to pay for bond authorizations. 89% is due to the direct costs and interest costs associated with that repayment schedule, as well as some of the other financial transactions. In this case, associated with the continued Transportation Revolving Loan Fund program and the necessary payments from that particular revolving loan fund. The final slide captures the graphic which is contained in your budget narrative. This graphic shows you the threshold that's been established for purposes of managing debt and establishing a threshold of debt to manage to. As you can see, the payment payments expected over time will remain, even through this biennium, under that 20% threshold. Even though we have approximately $150 million worth of bonds that remain uncommitted. And so that is a quick summary, Mr. Chairman, of the State Roads construction debt and change level items. And I believe that wraps up MnDOT's overall briefing on all of its budget program recommendations. We would stand for any additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hinkle. And your most recent comment here about $150 million in bonds that are uncommitted, what does that mean, uncommitted?
The law requires certain spending occur by the year 2016 for Chapter 152 bonds. Of the Chapter 152 commitments to the state, only $150 million remains uncommitted of that program. And so that remains available for purposes of meeting the requirements of Chapter 152.
And that's figured into this roughly 16% of the 20% for debt service.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I was just going to ask Mr. Hinkle. Mr. Hinkle, the 20% threshold is established as a matter of MnDOT policy, which I appreciate.
Yes.
I know it hasn't been quite screwed down super tight in recent years, so it's good to have a good policy. But can you just tell us some of the underlying policy rationale for choosing the 20% threshold? What are the factors in consideration in establishing that ceiling?
Mr. Hinkle.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, the analysis that was undertaken to establish that threshold was based on a number of factors. One of the primary factors that was evaluated was risk when it comes to the overall budget layout and the percentage of funds that need to be available to address potential changes in budget status and budget situations. As the department worked with MMB and you in establishing these thresholds, we didn't just look at the state of Minnesota and how funds have been managed, but we talked with the financial experts that exist in the state as well as across the country and looked at how states and financial institutions manage their budgets and their revenues, and looked in particular at the bonding authorities and what their level of acceptability would be as we looked at our bond rating and looked at how much risk those financial institutions are willing to take. Those are some of the primary factors that were established in helping us to establish a threshold that seemed reasonable to manage our risk as well as to manage the risk associated with being able to continue bonding programs and to have those funds available to the state for purposes of infrastructure improvement.
So,
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I know there's been discussion about, well, there's a big article in the paper today about managing our pavement conditions. And there's discussion, I know, internal to the agency and shared with you a little bit, Mr. Chair, and with me more recently, about managing the other kinds of risk to our overall system, like the condition of our pavement presents a fairly significant risk, both to the roadway system program. If we let it go too far, then we're contemplating huge expenditures in the future to rehabilitate to a degree that we wouldn't if we just came in and did routine maintenance. And then it threatens our overall credit rating as a state to our general obligation bond rating, because then we carry this, you know, this huge liability of bad roads that ultimately we have to address. So is that analysis factored into this 20%, or is it going to be the subject of a future analysis? We might have to use leverage in financing to get ahead of the game to address the condition of our roads and Senator Howe's district especially.
Mr. Hinkle?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, that's a separate analysis, but I would say that it is related to the topic of a threshold. Mm-hmm. What you're relating to specifically is the impact that infrastructure has on potential bond rating. And as infrastructure deteriorates and as those institutions that offer bonds look at the status of infrastructure, they look at its status as a determinant, as an indicator of how this state is performing and what its priorities are. Those bond facilities look at infrastructure as being extremely important. And the current trend could potentially endanger the state's bond rating if that infrastructure, in particular pavement conditions, reach a point where they feel that that's an issue.
Senator Lilly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hinkle, as you're going through the process of providing the services, transportation services, and budgeting for that, obviously the major section of that is going to be what, you know, where do we provide the services, what are they, how do we provide them. But a driving force is the standards that we establish in each mile of road, in each trail, in each system that we have. When your engineers look at those products and what, setting those standards, are we evaluating the cost drivers in those, and do we look at, all right, if we say this has to be this wide or this has to be this way, what process do your engineers go through to evaluate the cost-benefit return of doing that type of a engineering standard?
Mr. Hinkle.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lilly, the driving analysis that the engineering staff use in making performance threshold determinations is life cycle analysis, which is a cost-benefit analysis of what it takes to ensure that we have sound infrastructure that comes to us at minimal cost over the life of that infrastructure. So the department and its engineers and staff have looked carefully at cost and infrastructure in determining those thresholds, in particular for pavement, but that goes for bridge as well as some of the other infrastructure that the department is responsible for.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for your overview of the governor's budget and recommendations, and we look forward to working with you as we move forward in the budgeting process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
There being no other business before the committee, we will adjourn.